Hello, I'm pleased to be joined today by Adam Whiteley, Head of Global Credit at Insight. Adam, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So you're the manager of the $1.9 billion BNY Mellon Global Credit Fund, as well as some responsible bond strategies. But before we come on to those, going to start with something topical. What do you make of the Federal Reserve's decision to cut interest rates by 0.5% last night?
It was clear that central banks had started the cutting cycle, but they're the biggest elephant in the room. And with them now cutting rates, we can be confident that the cutting cycle is upon us. Mm-hmm. The reason that they're cutting is that they feel a lot more confident in the inflation outlook getting back to their targets.
Yeah.
And that means that now they can focus on the second part of their mandate, which is full employment. And to the extent that they've announced a 50 basis point or 0.5% cut means that they want to be more forceful in terms of getting things going. They don't want to be seen in terms of falling behind the curve. But equally, we probably shouldn't expect 0.5% cuts at each meeting in the coming months.
Right.
But it's very clear that they want to remove what is currently a policy setting which is actively slowing down the economy. They don't want to get to the point where they're actively stimulating the economy, but they want to get to somewhere that's much more balanced.
Okay. And rate cuts, normally we think good for bonds. Is it that simple?
It's that simple in terms of it's a mechanistic lower rates equals higher bond prices, but it's about what was already in the price. So actually what we've seen in terms of the price action over the last 24 hours is relatively muted in bond land. Mm. So to that extent, maybe investors were expecting...
Because am I right in saying kind of, well, say a week ago, maybe it was kind of split between thinking there'd be a 25 and 50 basis point cut, and then it moved towards 50 basis points as a consensus.
Absolutely. Now, this undoubtedly has been the meeting that has had the most uncertainty attached to it for a number of years.
Yeah.
But the market was pricing a higher probability of the 0.5% compared to the 0.25%. And so back to your question on, you know, lower rates equals good for bonds. Yes, they are. But if it's already in the price, then you won't see an immediate reaction.
Yeah.
But what we certainly would expect to happen now is this will cement in a lot of investors' minds that I'm not going to be getting the same returns on either my bank deposits or my money market fund instruments as I have been in recent history. And therefore, we should expect a lot of money to start flowing into the fixed income markets in general.
Right. And can I put you on the spot and say, did you think it would be a 50 basis point cut?
We actually probably would have said 25,
okay.
But you know, very finely balanced. And when we're thinking about any individual meeting, it's actually less about the cut or the hike, and it's more about the other information that comes with it. So looking at what are the projections forward that the Federal Reserve or any other central bank is making, where in a lot of cases, they will provide their own forecasts for growth, for inflation, for unemployment, as well as where they expect policy rates to be going.
There's a kind of point I wanted to pick up there, which is that market expectations for how many cuts there would be in the US this year have gyrated wildly this year. You know, we entered 2024 with four cuts priced in. And now, actually, that's what the Fed itself is predicting again, based on the so-called dot plot. I suppose the sheer level of kind of movements that we've seen in expectations for cuts. Is that normal, or has this been a kind of unusually unpredictable period?
It's not normal. And in many ways, this cycle has been unprecedented.
Right.
You'd really struggle to find a parallel. So the movement in terms of expectations for what central bankers are doing talks to the ongoing economic policy and political uncertainty. But there's also some other factors at play in that now you've got a lot more involvement in bond markets from non-traditional investors that have a different time horizon potentially to what someone like me and our team would be focused on. So traders that are focused on how do I try and generate some profits over a period of may even be hours or days rather than taking a time horizon that's over months,
so
if not years.
Becoming more short term.
Potentially, yeah.
And why is that? Is that because it's easier for people to trade bonds now than it was, say, 20 years ago?
If we think about what's the single most important ingredient for anyone that is actively managing their investments to add value, it's volatility itself, because volatility presents opportunity. So we went from a period post-financial crisis where central banks were suppressing volatility, arguably suppressing opportunities. And all of a sudden, over the last few years, you've had this explosion where they, as central bankers, have really let things go because they've been putting rates up. That's created a lot more volatility and with it opportunity. And funnily enough, if that creates an opportunity for people to be generating investment returns, more money will come in to try and access that.
Okay. And so does that mean also, say, in your credit fund, you find yourself trading a lot more than, say, 5 years ago?
We see a lot more opportunity and dislocations that we want to try and take advantage of today, that's for sure.
Okay. I mean, one other point I wanted to return to is, you mentioned, for example, that this rate cut should see people coming out of money market funds into funds like yours, that kind of thing. And the tone of kind of response from lots of fixed income investors has been a bit like, well, game on. But I've read a kind of other side of the story, which is that now the focus maybe isn't on bringing inflation under 2% in the same way as it might have been traditionally. And so in that sense, maybe, you know, the expected trajectory for interest rates over the kind of medium to long term might be a bit higher. And so actually that's a bit bearish for bonds. Do you kind of recognize that as well?
There's definitely some truth in that. What we shouldn't expect is that policy rates are going to go back to where they were post-COVID.
Right.
Yeah, you had an extraordinary period where policy rates basically got to the so-called lower bound or zero or close to zero or even negative in some cases. The economy doesn't need that anymore. That was an aberration. Mm. So what we should actually expect is, whether it's for the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve, they're going to try and get policy rates back to maybe more like a 3% level, which is significantly lower than where we are today. But that is where they think that their policy will be in balance. So neither stimulating nor restricting the economy.
Okay. But maybe, you know, so we won't see cuts all the way back down to zero, but still quite a lot of cuts to come then.
Correct.
Okay. And, you know, mentioning the Bank of England, we're speaking, the day after the Fed decision, but actually the Bank of England have just decided to hold rates, you know, having cut for the first time this cycle in August. What do you kind of make of that decision? Have you had time to have a look at the messaging around it?
That really is hot off the press. So yeah. I've only really seen most of the headlines. But the approach that they seem to be talking is one that's very gradualist. You know, they're not in a hurry to cut rates. So they're embarking on that path of lower rates, which will continue into 2025. But they don't feel any urgency to be really cutting in 50s or bigger increments like we saw from the Fed yesterday. And maybe one of the differences for the Bank of England is that they do still see some domestic inflationary pressures. So they really want to be confident that inflation story is in the past before they start cutting more aggressively.
Okay. And, a sort of last question, I suppose, a last question on interest rates, perhaps. A soft landing has now kind of become the consensus view for the economy. We seem to have avoided the terrible recession everyone was worried about. Do you agree with that? And do you think there are kind of risks to that consensus?
Soft landing is our central case. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to recognize that the phrase that's been used quite a lot, that the runway is narrow, is absolutely the right phrase to be considering.
We're not out of the woods.
We're not out of the woods. A central case doesn't mean that it has a high probability of happening. So what does a soft landing mean? It means that inflation comes back to central bank targets, but you don't see any real negative effects on growth or by extension on the employment markets. That's achievable. And so far, the body of evidence would suggest that it looks like it will actually play out that way. The Federal Reserve's projections, the Bank of England, the ECBs, they all talk the soft landing. And that is our view as well. Mm. But equally, now you've got economies that are much more in balance. There is a more symmetrical chance of having a good surprise, as well as the more scary negative surprises that I'm sure you and many others can think about.
If we step back a bit, so the company you work for, Insight Investments, let's just make sure everyone understands exactly kind of what it is and where it fits in. So it manages about £660 billion. A lot of that is LDI, so kind of these strategies aimed at pension funds, which came to prominence, we might say, after the kind of ill-fated budget in the Liz Truss era 2 years ago. But broadly, you know, Insight is the fixed income unit within the kind of asset management business of BNY. Is that right? Is that how you see the relationship?
So BNY is our parent.
Yeah.
They own us along with our employees. That has two key benefits to us. The first is the stability of the world's biggest custodian. Mm-hmm. And the second is the distribution reach that it gives us.
Right.
So what BNY is focused on is managing the money, moving the money, and keeping it safe. And I would fit within the managing the money part. They own a number of other asset managers that will have a different focus to Insight. So we very much do one thing, it's fixed income and it's bonds, whether it's in active fixed income where I sit, risk management solutions where that LDI strategy would be. But we have complete investment autonomy, complete independence from the other BNY-owned asset managers like Newton or maybe like Walter Scott.
Right. And do you think it helps just to focus on fixed income? I mean, that's a bit of a gimme there potentially, but do you think that's helpful to have a single focus like that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have to be best in class at what we do, otherwise we don't have a business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, you know, speaking primarily to your global credit fund, but we will comment a bit, I think, to the Responsible Horizon kind of bond fund strategies as well. You've outperformed a lot in recent years. How important has kind of having lower duration versus the market been to that outperformance?
That was certainly a driver, particularly in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
What we're here to do is to try and find the opportunities and be dynamic in the way that we manage our strategies. So 2022, having less interest rate duration, less sensitivity to interest rates going up, that would have been a tailwind. But actually, that means flipping on its head over the last 12 months or so, where actually we thought that government bonds were offering much more attractive value. So they're having more interest rate sensitivity, which has benefited us as yields have come down.
Is that difficult to do, to make that switch? Because you think, oh, this has been the key driver for us. You know, how do you know when to kind of abandon that?
It's process, but it's having freedom in a framework. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We want to be intentional about the risks that we are taking, and we want to be deliberate about when we're changing our positions. I'm very fortunate that I've got a big team. So it's 164 fixed income professionals. We're focused on one thing. It's trying to add value for clients in fixed income, in bonds. Mm-hmm. We've got a geographic presence, which means that we've got a very even mix of resources between Europe and North America. So having the boots on the ground, the eyes and the ears, and the two key investment locations. But it's about having a coherent, repeatable, deliberate way of consuming an awful lot of information and distilling it down into what's really valuable and what actually creates a difference between our opinion and the way that markets are currently priced.
Okay. Maybe you know, you can kind of explain a bit more to us about that process with a couple of examples. You know, you've mentioned before that you saw a bit of an opportunity in some financial bonds last year around the time of the kind of Silicon Valley and US bank crisis. Can you tell us a bit more about that and you know, how you think about a situation like that and how it kind of fits into your process?
First of all, we didn't see that coming.
No.
okay. So that came as a surprise to us. But then it becomes trying to recognize the difference between risk and opportunity.
Yeah.
And first and foremost, it means bringing it back to fundamentals. So getting the credit analysis resources that just focus on the fundamental view of a company or a sector. So bringing it back to basics. You know, mm-hmm. What are the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats within a, you know, within a business model or a company level? So once you've got a handle on that, you can feel comfortable around, is this a company in a sector that's investable? But then we need to look at what's in the price. So then we look at versus history, where is a particular sector like the banks trading relative to the broader industrial complex? And in that particular instance, what we would have observed was that it was trading as cheap pretty much as they'd ever done outside of when you had the very stressful Eurozone sovereign crisis in 2010, 2011.
Is this kind of bank debt specifically in the US or in general?
So actually, you know, our approach would have been to not put all our eggs in one basket. You know, you want to build in some diversification because that's your first line of defense.
Mm-hmm.
There was opportunity in the US, not in the smaller banks that were failing and smaller banks that were really stressed and then muddled through. It was typically in those that were guilty by association. So much larger banks where investors don't do the same depth of work as we would do, but they arrive at the same conclusion. But then also with my global remit, looking, is there an opportunity elsewhere? Has this spilled over into Europe? Answer,
yeah.
Yes, in a bad way for some of the Swiss banks, but equally that created further opportunity to own some of the blue chip names that everyone would know within the European banking system.
Yeah. I suppose I'm curious. I mean, that sounds like a lot of work. Obviously it is. But, you know, in fast moving markets, you know, when you have to go to basics and then you're looking at, you know, what names are interesting, What issues from those names are interesting. I mean, how do you kind of get through that sheer volume of work versus thinking, okay, we can see there's an opportunity there. You know, we need to kind of act quickly. You know, someone's calling us up. We're being offered these bonds. You know, we need to decide now. How do you kind of balance that? You know, doing the in-depth work versus the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a sporting context, you'd say, you know, your process is your training. That's mm-hmm. why you go to the training ground every day, such that when you get put in the red zone, you know exactly what set of decisions you're supposed to be making. Mm.
Creates almost a bit of instinct then.
It's instinct, but it's following a defined, a very deliberate process.
Yeah.
So that we know what behaviors you're supposed to be following. Mm-hmm. We know what works for us and what's key in terms of our investment process, and you're trying to really take in all of that information and distill it down into what are the really important drivers. And I think actually that's one of the skills that across any asset class, any style of fund management, that's the real key skill. There's so much information out there in a digital age. It's removing the bit that you don't need and trying to figure out what are the really important bits that are going to move markets, that are going to create opportunities.
Okay. And, you know, we're not in a period quite a volatility quite like that today, but I'm always kind of amazed if I look at, I'm often amazed if I look at government bond yields and how they've moved even just over 1 month. You know, it can often be a lot. I suppose, what are your instincts telling you about the kind of dynamic now, you know, after that Fed rate cut?
We'd say that actually both government bonds and corporate bonds at the moment are broadly fair value. So it's not obvious that they're either rich or cheap in terms mm-hmm. of expecting big moves up in price or big reductions in price. Mm. That's not to say that there isn't a very powerful income story here. So today, the income is very much back in fixed income, and actually in certain asset classes is rivaling the returns that you would normally expect from owning equities or shares over the long run. Where we're focused is really on our relative value decisions. So it's the power of incremental gains rather than, you know, putting on very big views that will benefit from the more sexy moves up and down.
Right.
So it's being deliberate in terms of having exposures to certain countries, mm-hmm. certain government bond markets, certain industry sectors, certain companies, or being very specific and disciplined in terms of where you take those exposures. So if you're thinking about shares or equities, you've got one decision. Do I own the share from that company or do I not? Now, within fixed income and corporate bonds in particular, typically I'll be able to own a 2-year bond, a 5-year bond, a 10-year bond, a 30-year bond in sterling and euros and dollars, a senior bond, a subordinated bond. I've actually got about 20,000 different choices that I can make.
Right.
And there's always some inefficiency in there in terms of eking out those incremental gains.
Okay. And so if you were going to summarize maybe sort of two or three key things you're looking at the moment or decisions you've made, what would they be in the global credit fund?
The first is we still see a lot of regional dislocation. Mm-hmm. There's still a lingering recession concern within Europe, which over the last few years you could have easily justified given the war on the doorstep, the energy crisis issues, and actually their central bank, the European Central Bank, was buying an awful lot of government and corporate bonds, and arguably they were changing the price therefore. They've now stepped away. The war in Ukraine goes on, but unfortunately for them, it looks like it's contained and the energy crisis seems that it's subsided. So on a forward-looking basis, we don't think the recession probabilities are dramatically different, either in the UK, Europe, or the US. But in terms of market pricing, there is still that concern. And we think, therefore, that there is more opportunity, better value within European fixed income than there is within the US, for example.
Okay. That's interesting because, you know, if I look at the fact sheet, this is the end of August for your global credit fund. You know, I think you've got about 60% of the fund is in US issuers, which is a bit overweight the benchmark, whereas, optically, you're a bit underweight Europe. Can you kind of explain that a bit?
Yeah, and that's really the next layer down of detail. So what you'll find is that a US company will issue bonds denominated in US dollars, as well as the euro, as well as pound sterling. Mm-hmm. Whether that company does good or bad, whether it defaults or whether it continues to repay, doesn't matter which currency you've invested in, but actually we can access the cheapness that you find within European assets without having to take a view on European country risk. I can buy the US companies.
Oh, I see. So you're buying a lot of kind of euro-denominated debt from US companies.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And yeah, I mean, one kind of last thing on maybe this area specifically. We heard for years that corporate debt had been ballooning at low interest rates, and that once rates rose, it wouldn't be sustainable. And yet, it doesn't seem like we've seen a kind of an amazing increase in defaults. You know, is that right? And why is that?
You're certainly right in terms of the trends. Defaults have been rising, but at a much slower pace than, frankly, we and many investors would have expected. And a lot of that talks to the strength of the starting point for the corporate sector. Mm-hmm. So firstly, balance sheets are in pretty good shape. So that's the health of the corporate, which gives them a cushion to absorb the more difficult environment and the higher interest rates. But also the speed at which those interest rate increases comes through is actually a lot slower than you might think. So if you think about it in terms of a fixed rate mortgage, if you've got a fixed rate mortgage that only rolled off in 5 years' time, you actually wouldn't have felt the impact of a lot of the hikes that we've seen because you were locked in before they happened. And it's the same for the corporate sector. So on average, it's between probably 5 and 7 years is the average maturity of a loan that the corporate has. And that means that whilst interest costs have been increasing, they've not been dramatically fed through to their earnings yet.
Okay. And so are we sort of out of the woods there, so to speak, or do you think that there's a kind of spike in defaults coming down the track?
There's still going to be pressure in an environment where we've got less growth, albeit positive. That's probably going to mean pressure on earnings. And that environment of higher borrowing costs is also going to be playing through. There are some other factors at play that maybe mean that, you know, defaults haven't disappeared. They may have simply changed hands. So we know that there's been an awful lot of borrowing that has been taken away from bank lending channels and, frankly, public fixed income channels is now in, you know, so-called private debt hands.
Right. Booming space of private credit.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you think actually a lot of the defaults have kind of shifted almost to that sector?
We simply don't know because by definition, it's a private sector. So you don't get access to the same information.
That's interesting. How do you think about that as a public fixed income manager then?
Well, for a lot of people, the private debt universe is going to be a sensible investment because you're getting paid typically a higher return for a similar level of risk, but you're getting paid because you can't actually buy and sell your underlying investments. So you need to have much more of a hold to maturity type mentality.
So you think it's just the illiquidity premium you're benefiting
from? That's exactly what it is. But you know, there will be undoubtedly some very good managers in that space that will navigate what has been a difficult period. But we simply don't have the numbers to say what's been going on in terms of the default rates there. We can look to probably the closest thing, which is maybe the leveraged loan market in the US.
Right.
And that has been seeing defaults tick up faster than within traditional high yield. But you know, we don't have the information. It's by its very nature a private market.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's talk about your responsible bond strategies a bit. I think, you know, some of these are definitely aimed at, you know, big institutions. But for example, you've got the Responsible Horizon Strategic Bond Fund, you know, that was launched 3 years ago. You know, it's only got to about 28 million in size. I suppose, have these responsible bond funds been a bit of a kind of hard sell during a period when people have kind of waned on ESG a bit?
Hard sell, I think, is probably the wrong phrase. But what we do find when it comes to ESG is there isn't really a strong consensus within the UK. Probably more so there is a consensus now in Europe. US is a completely different picture where it's very politicized. So trying to find a consensus set of views that you should incorporate in a mutual fund where lots of investors can allocate is tricky.
Right.
So what we typically would find that in fund format, investors look for three things. They look for a three-year track record demonstrating that you can add value. Mm-hmm. They look for good performance over that 3 years. And typically, you know, they will want to feel comfortable with the investment objective meeting their needs.
Yeah.
So hopefully that fund now, having gone through its three-year anniversary, puts a tick in the first two boxes.
Okay.
And we're increasingly confident that investors are seeing the benefits of having what should be a best-in-class fixed income fund but also considering non-financial objectives. So thinking more carefully about aligning the opportunity set that we will invest money within with the end investor's actual values.
Yeah. And I suppose in a nutshell, I mean, is this quite a kind of dark green strategy, or is it more about sort of avoiding, you know, the kind of worst actors, so to speak?
It's a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is incorporating sustainability themes. That means thinking about the long run sustainability of the businesses that we invest in. Are they compatible with what we expect to be a different world in the future? Mm-hmm. It does mean excluding the worst offenders when it comes to the more sensitive sectors, or indeed where there is just poor levels of either environmental, social, or governance factors. But we also do have what you would probably define as a more dark green allocation, where we have what's called so-called impact bonds. So these are use of proceeds bonds where within fixed income, you can see direct linkage between an investor's capital and it actually being used and ring-fenced for projects that may be, for example, changing for a utility company, their coal power generation into wind or solar.
Yeah. Okay. I want to kind of ask a kind of last broader investment question, really. Property is a sector, you know, we kind of mentioned a bit, and I think somewhere where you have been, you know, taking a bit of a view on some kind of specific areas in the US and Europe, particularly in the UK, commercial property in general is pretty unloved. So can you, I suppose, yeah, can you discuss a bit the opportunities you're finding?
It's not a broad-based opportunity, mm-hmm. so you do have to be very deliberate, disciplined in terms of where you aren't taking your exposure and intentionally where you are. Property sector has very much been in the crosshairs because it's challenged by those higher interest rates.
Yeah.
Challenged because a property company's business model is I borrow and I then invest at a higher rate. And when your borrowing cost goes up, you know, funnily enough, you're less profitable, but also because of those challenges I was talking to in terms of property values, so the actual assets themselves.
Yeah, sort of questions about, say, like, are we still going to go to shopping centres?
Exactly, exactly.
Or, you know, are we going to go to slightly rubbish offices? You know?
So here, we're leveraging the resources that we've got in terms of 41 credit analysts that are just focused on fundamentals and the drivers of these property businesses, but looking at the different subsectors and looking at the different geographies, and not all are created equal. You know, for example, I'm sure that many of us will use online delivery, and that means having, you know, giant chains of warehouses and logistics. Mm. That's not really changed over the last 5 years, whereas maybe the shopping patterns have. So it's that guilty by association that we referred to earlier with the banks that typically creates the opportunity. There are many companies invested in logistics that have seen their valuations become cheaper just because of the general smell with the sector. So that's where we're trying to identify the difference between what's a risk and what's actually opportunity.
So say, you know, in that kind of logistics related debt, that's something you've looked at in a lot of different markets, or is it kind of specific?
That one more interested in Europe. But in terms of where do we look for opportunity, it's agnostic when it comes to geography.
Okay. I want to finish with a kind of a bit of a different question, really. Firstly, you've actually been at Insight since you did the grad scheme, right?
Yeah, 17 years and counting.
Yeah, so it's a long time. I suppose I wanted to ask you, what do you think makes a good bond investor? I mean, I always remember the statement from Bill Gross where he said he thinks, you know, he was an absolute legend at PIMCO. And he said, one third mathematician, one third economist, and one third horse trader. Is that something you agree with yourself?
I've not heard that particular
phrase before.
Well, I
suppose where do you see yourself breaking down on that?
But I do agree that you need a mix of qualities, but it doesn't mean that there's a single winning formula.
Right.
The way I would see it, and certainly my and our philosophy, is that we want to combine, you know, top-down asset allocations, the more macro or economic thinking, with bottom-up stock picking.
Okay.
There's an element of certainly being comfortable with numbers helps within that. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that when I look across the different backgrounds of the people that I work with, that we're only mathematicians or scientists. Like, you want a diversity of thought.
Right.
That's what creates different perspectives.
All right. Okay. Well, let's leave it there. So, thanks very much for coming in, and good to learn more about how you do things.
Thanks for having us.